Welcome to the program for Friday, August 31st, 2012 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today is the last Federal News Countdown of the summer of 2012. And I have two great experts choosing the news stories in the countdown today. Rob Burton of Venable, who is a veteran of the Federal News Countdown. It's great to see you, my friend.
It's great seeing you. Thanks for having me back.
I'm happy to do it. It's a great way to end the summer for the countdown season to have you on here. And also on the Federal News Countdown with me today for his first tour on the show is Jeff Neal of ICF International. It is good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you.
Glad you're on the program today. Each of you has chosen the news stories from this week that you think are the three most important to people who work for the federal government. And, of course, we start with
number three.
Jeff Neal, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is Joe Davidson's column from the Washington Post. The headline is GOP platform angers federal labor leaders. And with all due respect to Joe's reporting, I have to say that my response when I saw this column was, duh, not a big surprise. I didn't really expect to see the folks from AFGE and NTEU and the NFFE and the other unions to say, oh, we're all of a sudden on board.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was news, but it was significant. And the significance to me is this continued use of federal employees as political footballs. It's happened again. It's happened for many years, and frankly, the other party's done it too in the past. The Clinton administration did some things with federal employees that kind of used them as footballs as well. My real concern about it is the impact it will have on federal recruiting. The federal government does a lot of really important things, and it needs talented people to be able to do that. And so I'm really concerned that being viewed as basically tools of politics will hurt federal recruiting, and that could be really significant.
I remain optimistic thanks to an effort in Congress, and I would cite the members that are promoting it, and I don't want to get them wrong. So, but there is an effort on both sides of the Hill to get agencies to quantify exactly what they do, kind of an inventory of sorts. And I think that's the best next step to try to figure out, once we know exactly what the government does line by line, and then the unions, anybody who's interested can take that list to the American people and say, this is everything that we do, and now let's have an educated, informed conversation about what you think the federal government should or shouldn't do, rather than the kinds of debates that we're seeing now.
Yeah, the types of proposals that are not helpful are the ones to say, okay, let's just cut 10% of the federal workforce. Which 10%? Do you do across-the-board cuts? If you do across-the-board cuts, do we cut the Border Patrol by 10%? We just spent the last 5 years growing, doubling the Border Patrol. Do we want to start cutting it now? Do we want to cut back on FBI agents? Do we want to cut back on Internal Revenue agents who are actually helping ensure that people pay their taxes? Do we want to cut those things?
Well, and even some of the positions that are not necessarily sexy or don't get a lot of attention among the public. I mean, every industry leader that I have in here from my industry chatter series on Thursday says the acquisition workforce still isn't nearly robust enough to buy effectively for the taxpayer.
Absolutely.
So your point there is well taken also. Right. Do we want to cut them 10%?
Right. So who are you left that you can cut 10%? You start running out of people. One of the things you find is when you ask, there was an interesting Pew poll recently that asked people, do you think the government should be smaller? The answer was yes. The majority of people said yes. Do you think you should cut defense? No. Do you think you should cut student loan programs? No. Do you think you should cut Social Security? No. So should you cut environmental enforcement? No. So people say, yeah, we want the government to be smaller. But when you list all these things the government does and say, should those be smaller? The answer in almost every case is no, they shouldn't.
That's why I'm optimistic for some kind of quantification of what it is that agencies do, and that some kind of dialogue will come out around that. Jeff Neal's third most important federal news story is from the Washington Post. The headline is GOP platform angers federal labor leaders. Coverage of the convention that just wrapped up in Tampa, and we'll talk about that more on the Federal News Countdown later on in the program. Rob Burton, your third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is VA seeks outsider to review conference planning policies. Now, my number one surprise in this story was why the Inspector General's office wasn't the place that VA went to try to learn more about this.
Well, they are. The Inspector General of VA is looking at this. But this is good news for GSA, don't you think? I think this is great news for GSA employees. It's like you're not the only one in town that they're taking a look at with respect to these conferences. But really, Francis, this is somewhat stunning. I mean, remember the outrage with respect to the GSA conference? But these are two conferences that were held last year by VA that cost over $5 million. That's a lot more than the GSA conference that was being reviewed. But I do think, and on a serious note, this is bad news for the government as a whole, because what it really suggests is that this problem is much broader than GSA, and the Congress is really going to start looking at this big time. As you know, Congressman Issa has already been saying, I'm going to look at 150 conferences that were held since 2005. There'll be more agencies to come, no question about it. But the abuse here is rather striking. Everybody was so outraged with GSA. Look at this one. They had giveaways at these conferences for federal employees that entailed spa treatments, concert tickets, stretch limo rides. This just does not play well in this environment.
Now, just about all the folks that I talked to about the concept of conferences, not about the specifics, the details here, but the concept in general, people say across the board, both in the private sector and in the government space, conferences are valuable for people to be able to talk to each other face-to-face. They're valuable for people to be able to obtain training, and they're cost-effective in many cases for training because you can concentrate a lot of people in one space. And the problem that I see is that the word conference is going to become such a bugaboo that nobody will want to participate in them at all, and especially in an environment where we're trying to encourage more conversations before proposals and before RFPs, RFIs, and so on in the contractor community. Where are those dialogues going to happen if they're not going to happen if there are not opportunities for people to get face-to-face and have these conversations?
Well, I think you're right, Francis, and they're calling them meetings now. They're not calling them conferences or expo.
Just change the name. You know, GSA, nobody will notice the difference.
And this is really interesting. Apparently at GSA Expo recently, they did not want to pay for iced tea, and so everybody had to drink water. We're getting into this extreme environment where, you're right, it's unhealthy. And my old office, the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, has put out guidance for the last couple of years saying how important it is for industry and government to communicate, to collaborate, to talk. And you're right, it is much easier in the context of a conference. What I'm really surprised at are the number of conferences. For example, the acting GSA administrator just put a kibosh on 45 conferences that were scheduled. 45? I mean, that is rather remarkable. So I do think there's a balance here and that agencies are going to definitely pull back. But as typical, that there's a knee-jerk reaction, and so now there will be no conferences or very, very limited ones, and that is too much of an overreaction.
And my colleague Tom Temin says his fear is that the ones that remain will look like what he calls high school football awards banquets, with a banquet table unfolded and a paper tablecloth and a couple of pastries from Costco on the table.
I think that sounded like the GSA Expo, maybe. You know, that they just recently have. But, you know, my recommendation, though, on this whole thing, Francis, I do think agencies have to take it seriously. They need to track these conferences. There needs to be an internal approval process at a high level. I think that agencies need to be focused on that more than anything.
Rob Burton's third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is VA seeks outsider to review conference planning policies. My colleague Julie Lee's story, and you can read that one and all of the stories that we're counting down today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Rob Burton and by Jeff Neal. When the Federal News Countdown continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Here's Seth Harris, Deputy Secretary, Department of Labor, on the Accelerate and Streamline for Better Customer Service panel, sponsored by CA Technologies.
Government has to be able to provide services in the way that people are accustomed to receiving services, particularly our younger customers. You know, customers from the ages of 18 to 35 are not emailing one another anymore. They're texting each other, and they want to be able to interact with their government in that way.
To listen to the whole program made possible by CA Technologies, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
At CA Technologies, we enable agencies to focus on service delivery, not just infrastructure, and on supporting strategic goals, not just fixing what's broken. We accelerate IT so agencies can drive innovation with the cloud and other new technologies. We transform IT to simplify complexity and free up resources. We secure IT to keep sensitive assets safe.
Find out how CA Technologies can help your agency accelerate, transform, and secure IT at ca.com/public sector.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7742.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON.
Central Michigan University's global campus in Metro DC.
I'm looking to
move up in my career,
make my mark in government,
keep my job, and still earn my degree. Earning my Master's of Public Administration degree from Central Michigan University's global campus gave me direction in my career in public service. The instructors were more like mentors. They helped me to hone in on exactly what it is that I wanted to do.
The possibilities are endless. With an NASPAA accredited MPA degree from Central Michigan University's global campus, the gold standard degree for government and nonprofit careers. Get it all at CMU's 7 local centers, Central Michigan University's global campus in Metro DC. Call 877-679-1268 or go online at cmich.edu/MetroDC.
Tom Temin here. Join me and Emily Kopp Monday morning, Labor Day, for a special best of edition of the Federal Drive. Hear great interviews like the NASA scientist who's searching for a way to get to Mars with electricity, or the Naval Academy prof who's parsing out a DARPA cyber program with the mysterious name Plan X. Plus the heartwarming tale of how furry critters are helping wounded warriors adjust. Those stories and much more Monday morning starting at 6 on the Best of the Federal Drive right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Rob Burton of Venable and Jeff Neal of ICF International. And we're up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal, is from the Christian Science Monitor. The headline is Hurricane Isaac Aftermath. Will FEMA have enough money? And one of the points that they make in this piece, Jeff, I thought was particularly interesting. Approval, referring to the money that the agency would need. Approval is likely, but not a given anymore. And I wonder if your experience in government historically, comparing that with what you're seeing now, if you think that that's standard operating procedure moving forward, that agencies can't take anything for granted when it comes to funding anymore.
Absolutely. I think money is going to be a big question mark for years to come. It used to be that when there was a disaster, we responded to the disaster first. That was a given that we would always respond, and the money would be found because people were in trouble. Now you hear folks saying, okay, we really think we need to find offsets for this. And I don't think we should be worried about finding offsets when we have people's houses underwater. It's a really important thing to be able to do. The other thing that really concerns me about this one is I think it just drives home the need for preparedness. One of the things we used to talk about a lot at DHS and things that we work with a lot at ICF now are issues around emergency preparedness. That's not just a federal issue. It's not just FEMA. It's not just FEMA and the federal government. It's the federal government with FEMA as a focal point. It's state and local jurisdictions and their preparedness. And then it's individual preparedness. You know, everybody who lives in an area where something could happen, which means anywhere on the planet, needs to have prepared themselves and their family for what happens in the event of an emergency. Do you have emergency food in your house? Do you have emergency water? Do you have the things you would need in the event there's a disaster here and everything goes down? Most people don't. And so it's really important that people focus on that preparedness. And this hurricane, like every other natural disaster that comes along, and the man-made disasters too, just drive home that point of preparedness over and over again. And also drive home the point that agencies like FEMA serve an incredibly important role. What's really interesting is some of the people who've been criticizing FEMA in the last few years are now saying FEMA needs to give their jurisdiction more money.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't like FEMA until they have water in their streets, and then they love FEMA and want more money from them.
And, Rob, FEMA is kind of a victim of its own success in the James Lee Witt era and now in what they've done to kind of try to modify themselves and reform themselves in the wake of the Hurricane Katrina response, because I saw a story this week where most of the United States thinks that FEMA is a first responder, considers them to be, even though they're not. Their expectation is that one of the key organizations that's going to help them in the event of an emergency is FEMA, that they're kind of the face of response. Every FEMA official I've talked to is very quick to remind me and my audience that that's not the case. But
well, what we learned at OMB during Katrina, because I was there during Katrina, was that every major agency is a first responder, GSA, DOD, DHS. I mean, and what we also learned is that acquisition personnel were really not trained to deal with emergency procurements, which was absolutely critical. And one of the focuses back in that time frame was to get agency people trained and also to have a catalog of who they were so that you could reach out to them immediately and say, please go down to New Orleans or wherever. And I do think a lot of progress has been made in that regard. And I do think that over the last 7 years, there has been improvements with respect to getting a cadre of experts together as the first responders from every major federal agency.
One of the things, Jeff, that it seems that your former agency has done is get out of that exchanging business cards mode,
right,
where when the emergency happens, they know who's going to show up on the scene from the
right
state, local jurisdictions and the NGOs and be able to deal with them on a more personal, maybe not totally mm-hmm. personal yet, but on a more personal relationship basis.
One of the things that really helped is having Craig Fugate as the administrator at FEMA. He's an emergency management professional. He spent a career doing this. He came out of state emergency preparedness. And so he understands how the federal government plays a role, but the state and local jurisdictions also play a very critical role. And he's actually been able, I think, to significantly improve FEMA's capabilities and also focus a lot on the idea that emergency response and emergency preparedness is actually a line of work by itself. It's something that people really need to know how to do. And you have to think a lot about it before an emergency happens. And so I think Craig's done a very, very good job with FEMA in getting them back on their feet again. FEMA, as you mentioned under Witt, FEMA had a really good reputation back then. And I think FEMA is getting that good reputation back. And frankly, I think they deserve to get it back. It's a good organization that does a lot of very, very good things.
What do you see, Rob, as far as the first question that I had for Jeff, which is, is this part of the new normal that we're looking at where nothing can be taken for granted as far as what agencies might need money-wise?
I do think, though, when it comes to priorities, that emergency response will be right up there as far as a priority. So I think FEMA is certainly going to be able to get their share of some needed and scarce procurement dollars. And I do agree with Jeff that I think they've come a long way. I think it's quite a professional agency, and I think the role they play in coordinating these responses is really mm-hmm. important. And the training, and we found that to be the case, is absolutely critical, especially in the acquisition arena.
Jeff Neal's second most important federal news story of the week is from the Christian Science Monitor. The headline is Hurricane Isaac Aftermath. Will FEMA have enough money? It is linked up now, like all of our stories, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Rob Burton's second most important federal news story of the week is next on the Federal News Countdown. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. Tune in next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 and 820 a.m. to hear the latest from the food and wine scene. We've got celebrity chefs, sommeliers, winemakers, and more all here to tell you about the inside skinny that you won't find anywhere else. That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday at 11.
It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
Conducting the business of government has never been more challenging, as agencies need to make even smarter procurement decisions. Now you can take the direct path to successful acquisitions with GSA's multiple award schedules. GSA makes it easier to get what you need, when you need it, on time and on budget. You'll save time and money by reducing costly delays in purchasing services and products with the flexibility and control you need to negotiate better pricing. GSA also provides best value through established contracts with pre-qualified vendors and streamlined access to a wide selection of contractors. You can also create blanket purchase agreements to meet your agency's recurring requirements. To find out how GSA's multiple award schedules can help you support your agency's needs, visit gsa.gov/ACQCPM. That's gsa.gov/ACQCPM.
The next generation of iPhone is going to support near-field communications. The Android already does. It's a protocol where you can just hold your phone up close to a device at the store, and you can make a payment without even bringing out your credit card. All your credit card information is in your cell phone. You just go there. You see something comes on your cell phone, the dollar amount, and you approve it, and bingo, you pay. So it's going to be the end of credit cards with this near-field communications.
Listen to Tech Talk at a special time this Saturday right after the Navy game.
Diabetes and death. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. More people have diabetes now than ever before. People with diabetes often have other health risk factors like obesity and high blood pressure. But data from the National Health Interview Survey shows that death rates are declining in both men and women with diabetes. Dr. Edward Gregg is with the Division of Diabetes Translation at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
From the time period of 1997 to 2006, death rates for any cause and for cardiovascular disease in particular declined in people with diabetes.
Those with diabetes can prevent their risk of cardiovascular disease by maintaining a healthy weight, healthy cholesterol levels, and by not smoking. The study in the journal Diabetes Care was supported by CDC and the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
So, guess what I just heard?
You mean about the Roth TSP?
Okay, yeah. Well, also...
that bid protest on the DOD contract.
Right. But did you know...
who the Senate confirmed for the administrator's job?
Well, what about...
OMB's digital strategy.
Jeez. How do you know everything that's going on in the federal government?
I know, because I signed up for Federal News Radio's email alerts.
Be in the know and know it first with Federal News Radio's email alerts. Sign up today at federalnewsradio.com. Search email alerts.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal of ICF International and Rob Burton of Venable. And Rob, your second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. My colleague Jack Moore's story, which is headlined, Sequestration Could Spell $39 billion in Cuts to Civilian Agency Budgets. This is an analysis that the Professional Services Council did based on the guidance that we have so far from the administration on where they expect sequestration to go. What I have found interesting about the sequestration dialogue is that we started out when this first looked like it was possible. I'm still not convinced it's going to happen. But when this first appeared possible, the conversation revolved around sequestration is terrible because it's across-the-board cuts, and as we talked about across-the-board personnel cuts earlier, across-the-board budget cuts are just as bad. Now the dialogue seems to have changed, and a lot of the conversation revolves around how can we shape the cuts that we have to put up with through sequestration and still be able to execute the mission. And the message I take away from that is that the financial people at the agency seem to think that they'll have a lot more flexibility than it first looked like they would.
Well, see, Francis, that's why I think this article is important. I know everybody's tired of hearing about sequestration. I almost left this out because I thought, oh, I don't really want to talk about this. But it is important. I'll tell you, the clients at the Venable Law Firm, the government contracts clients, are really concerned about this. I've never seen such concern from government contractors on any one issue, and it's just huge, and mainly because of all the uncertainty that you just spoke about. But yeah, the good news here is that there's going to be an extraordinary amount of latitude by the chief financial officers at every federal agency. And so the cut we're looking at, the top line cut, for example, looks like it'd be 7.8% with respect to civilian agency budgets. And that doesn't necessarily mean any particular program or project in an agency will be cut at all. It means that they're going to have to maybe cut more than one program, more than 7%, maybe one less. There will be latitude in that regard. Now, the president, as you know, this is timely because the president's going to be required on September 8th to present a detailed report to Congress on exactly how this is going to work down to the program, project, activity levels within an agency, and how much latitude there really will be. So there's going to be a lot of clarity here, much more so than there is today as you and I are speaking. And OMB is supposed to issue guidance on this whole subject. So there's more to come. What I thought was interesting about this article was, A, we finally get a figure here, 7.8%. We get some feeling for exactly what will the impact be, at least at a top-line level. And the concept of latitude. There's no question that agencies are going to have a fair amount of discretion and latitude with respect to what programs and projects are going to cut and by what percentage. So I think that is good news.
Jeff, I think the administration, although proposing cutting anything is never popular and somebody will always pick on you for it, I think the administration has the potential to come out of this Sequestration Transparency Act exercise looking like the heroes. And the reason that I say that is because I've been beating the drum on this for a couple of years now, not just because of sequestration. But I think it is a great position for the administration to be in to say, here's what we think the government could do without. Mm-hmm. Now, Congress, you tell us why we're wrong, and you go back and justify to the people in your district and in your states why we shouldn't do this. And yes, there will be some people who will be able to make a pretty strong case. Well, it'll jobs in our district and all that jazz. But overall, I think more broadly, there is an understanding that this has to happen. And if we believe that the voters are adults and are ready to engage in this conversation, I think the administration making the first move here will make them look a lot better in the minds of the voters than Congress, who is it's blatantly obvious they want to do nothing at all about this if they can avoid it.
Well, let me disclose a small bias here. I worked in this administration for a couple of years, and so I will admit I have a small bias. This administration has been very specific about what it would do and has done. And so what we've seen is a president who has said he would do certain things. He did them. And in this instance, again, he's going to say specifics about what he would do. My concern is that people in Congress may say, no, Mr. President, we don't agree with your solutions at all, and then stop at that and not really have a dialogue and say, okay, we don't like your cuts. Here are our cuts. I think 2 months before an election, it's going to be hard to get them to line up and say, okay, here are the things we would cut, because of what I mentioned earlier, that people say they like the idea of cutting government, but they don't like to cut anything in particular. And giving the federal agencies the choice of where to make the cuts is sort of like saying to them, wow, you have a choice now of cutting off your left arm or your right. Pick one. I don't know if that's going to help in a lot of cases, because some agencies operate so close to the edge on finances that a 7% cut is going to be pretty catastrophic for some of them, particularly for ones where the bulk of their money is not really discretionary money. To cut that much, they're going to have to stop doing things that people expect them to do.
But Francis, I think with this whole topic, I think sequestration is somewhat of a red herring, because the bigger issue here is that there will be budget cuts. I mean, it's inevitable, and it may not be in the form of the sequestration process, but I think it's going to happen, and it's only a matter of when. So, agencies are going to be cutting programs. Congress is going to have no choice but to cut programs.
But cutting every agency isn't the way to do it. The way to do it is to decide what things maybe the government doesn't need to be doing
anymore.
And
that kind of goes back to that inventory idea that I talked about earlier.
Well, of course, it's something Congress just has never been able to deal with, because politically no one wants to make those hard choices. My point is, I think they're eventually going to have to make those hard choices, because there really will be no other choice.
The worst possible outcome, though, would be to do sequestration, to have the catastrophic effects on the economy that would happen as a result of that, and then to be left with a bunch of crippled agencies that can't do anything very well. That's like the worst. And that's the reason sequestration from the very beginning was viewed as this unthinkable thing. If you recall when it passed, the idea was, we will come up with something so horrible that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, the legislative branch nor the executive branch, would let it happen, because it's so bad. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about how we implement this thing that's so bad that nobody wants it to happen.
It's interesting that you say that. Not too long ago, I talked to a staffer from the Hill who had retired now, but was there when Graham Rudman Hollings mm-hmm. was written, that included sequestration originally. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he said. This was devised to be something that looked so ridiculous that nobody would ever want to be associated with with it actually happening. And here it is happening.
Well, of course, and it did happen once in history. What were the years? I can't remember, but some of my friends at OMB were there, and when they did actually implement it.
Late '80s,
I think it was the late '80s. I mean, it's been a while, but it has happened before. But I have a lot of faith in Congress. I'm convinced that they will kick this can down the road.
Figure out some way to patch it.
Any good politician is not going to want to deal with this. And so I think that's my prediction.
There's another real concern I have about this, and it is not because I've gone from the federal world to the consulting world. A lot of federal agencies, when they're told to cut, are going to protect their staff first. Instead of protecting capability of the agency, they're going to protect their staff. And they may be able to minimize the number of job losses within government by doing that, but they will just transfer those job losses to the private sector, and they may at the same time significantly reduce the capability of the agency to get its mission done. That's a real concern.
Rob Burton's second most important federal news story of the week is headlined, Sequestration Could Spell $39 billion in Cuts to Civilian Agency Budgets. My colleague Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com. It is on the in-depth page right now, so you can read it and all of the stories on the Federal News Countdown. We're up to number one. The most important story of the week is selected by Rob Burton and Jeff Neal when the countdown continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Did it, didn't you?
I did.
Went to HDRadio.com, shopped around, ditched my old car radio, and got a digital entertainment center with HD radio technology.
Did you pay much?
I paid exactly what I had in mind. There were more than 40 models to choose from with all kinds of digital features.
Like the HD2, HD3 channels?
Yep.
Digital traffic?
Yep.
Artist experience?
Yep.
iTunes tagging?
Yep. I followed your advice and got more with HD radio technology.
I'm proud of you, bro.
HD radio. More radio, more value.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd.
I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
$1.2 trillion in across-the-board spending cuts are set to hit federal agencies starting January 2nd. What programs will be affected, and how are agencies preparing? Will federal employees be furloughed? And how will contractors handle the funding reductions? The clock is ticking. Congress has 4 months to agree on alternative cuts before sequestration becomes a reality. Find the latest news at federalnewsradio.com/sequestration.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
The Defense Research Agency, DARPA, is looking for revolutionary technologies that can help the Pentagon win a cyber war. Martin Libicki is a senior management scientist at RAND and a cybersecurity professor at the U.S. Naval Academy.
They seem to be looking for better ways of commanding and controlling cyber forces, talking about things such as situational awareness, the overall grasp of forces, the understanding of the complete battlefield.
FederalNewsRadio.com/Federal Drive.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown every week includes the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts are Rob Burton from the Venable Law Firm and Jeff Neal of ICF International. Both of them a lot of experience inside the federal government. And we are up to, on the countdown,
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal, is headlined, "To Hero Astronaut Armstrong Moonwalk, Just a Job." And I will say, one of my colleagues in the federal government media world, Tom Shoup, wrote a terrific analysis of some of the coverage, Jeff, about the passing of Neil Armstrong, reminded us, first of all, that he was a civilian and not a member of the military, as I thought he was. I just assumed because the other astronauts up to that time were uniformed military, mostly pilots, that he was as well. But there was just there were a lot of elements to the Armstrong story that we were reminded of with his passing.
Neil Armstrong, I think, is the personification of one of the great accomplishments, I think, in our history, not just American history, in the history of this planet. And he was a federal employee. The man walking on the moon was a federal employee. The man who took all those risks was a federal employee. The team of people who put he and Buzz Aldrin on the moon were federal employees. They were contractors that supported NASA. They were the military. It was a collective effort that got us to the moon, and we didn't get to the moon in a 20 or 30 year period. It was within the decade of the 60s, and it was an amazing accomplishment. And Neil Armstrong made it very clear that it wasn't just him, and I think that speaks a lot about the character of the program and the character of the man. He also didn't cash in. I mean, in an era when everybody cashes in on everything, and it seems like it's every man or woman for himself, Neil Armstrong could have cashed in just enormously on what he had done. I mean, how many people get to be the first man on the moon? He's the one and only. He didn't do that. So I think he was an amazing story. Frankly, as a child of the 60s, as somebody who, like most little boys in the 60s, grew up wanting to be an astronaut and watching everything that happened and watching this live on television when the landing happened and the first moonwalk happened, I think his passing is just so enormously significant that nothing else could top that as the top story of the week.
Neil Armstrong said in the year 2000, according to this story from federalnewsradio.com, "I take a substantial amount of pride in the accomplishments of my profession." Rob, he didn't say, "I take a tremendous amount of pride in my accomplishments or the accomplishments of myself and the guys on my team or any of that." He was giving credit to the entire engineering profession that was responsible for the success that we had in getting to the moon.
Well, you know, he certainly did not, I did not know he was a federal employee. I think Jeff told me he was a GS-15. I mean, you do think of astronauts as military personnel, mm-hmm. and I never realized he was a civilian GS-15,
yeah,
which is pretty pretty impressive. But, you know, he was not an egotistical man at all. You know, he led a pretty low profile, mm-hmm, after he finished his career. And I think Jeff is right. You know, he just has those qualities that you want any public servant to have.
He said he was a nerdy pocket protector engineer, and he was proud of that. And I think what NASA accomplished with the moon landings was just a phenomenal accomplishment for everyone.
And what's going on with Mars right now is rather interesting. Well, that's just amazing.
That's where I wanted to go next, because that whole situation with the Curiosity landing on Mars gave me a tremendous amount of hope for the things that the three of us and the people listening to this program ostensibly care about, and that is the care and feeding of people who work for the federal government. Think about it, even though it was just a boomlet, it was just for a couple of days. Think about the people who were so enamored with Mohawk Guy. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, his name escapes me, and I wish I could recall his name off the top of my head. But people, for a couple of days at least, there was this perception that working for the federal government was something that was pretty cool, because this guy worked for the federal government. And the guy who didn't get enough attention in my mind was the Grateful Dead looking guy who was next to him, the guy with the long hair and everything, who looked like he just came back from the Fish concert.
And it was, you know, it's funny that happened at like 1:30 in the morning,
mm-hmm,
and there was nothing to see because there was no video. So you were watching a video of a control room.
Mm-hmm.
I was up at 1:30 in the morning watching the control room at NASA, watching this happen, just because it was such a fascinating thing to see. And when you look at the story, and if you go to NASA's website, they actually have a simulation of what the landing would look like, called 7 Minutes of Terror. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The process they came up with to land this thing was brilliance. It was absolutely brilliant. And the idea that these people are still there working, still doing these kinds of things, I think is just fantastic. And I hope when we start talking about cutting the budget, that cutting something like NASA and cutting this quest for knowledge is not one of the first victims of the budget acts. Because if we just limit ourselves to this planet and what happens here, we're basically saying our future is very limited, and we're not really going to grow as a species. And I think that would be really sad.
One of my crack producers, Beth Reardon, tells me that Mohawk Guy's name is Bobak Ferdowskis, and I hope I got that. I hope I pronounced it correctly.
Nice hair.
It's
I appreciate any kind of hair.
Well, you know, it's the same thing. Burton here has a terrific head of hair, and besides that's really it for this particular room right now.
I think so.
The most important federal news story of the week from Jeff Neal is about the passing of Neil Armstrong, the first American, the first person on the face of the moon. And you can read it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Rob Burton's choice for the most important federal news story of the week. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7744.
I'm Ronnie Mervis. Attention all golfers. Swing that club for a chance to win $1 million at the Mervis Diamond Million Dollar Invitational. Join me for a fabulous day of golf on Wednesday, September 12th at Whiskey Creek in Frederick, Maryland, designed by Ernie Els. You could walk away with a cool $1 million prize, or win a Mervis Diamond, Tacori Fashion Jewelry, or a trip to South Africa, courtesy of South African Airways, and more. Won't she just love you for that? Everyone will be at this prestige event. Play golf with your best clients or just bring your buddies for a fun day and great networking. The entry fee includes breakfast, dinner, and awards reception. Proceeds go to Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Awareness. Your mother, wife, girlfriend, sister, and daughter will thank you for your support of a worthy cause. Ladies, send your men to play. Don't delay. Get in while you can. Corporate sponsors and their guests are welcome. I can see you sinking those putts at the $1 million Invitational on September 12th. Register today at MervisDiamond.com/golf. Again, that's MervisDiamond.com/golf.
Central Michigan University's global campus in Metro DC.
I'm looking to
move up in my career,
make my mark in government,
keep my job and still earn my degree. Earning my Master's of Public Administration degree from Central Michigan University's global campus gave me direction in my career in public service. The instructors were more like mentors. They helped me to hone in on exactly what it is that I wanted to do.
The possibilities are endless. With an NASPAA accredited MPA degree from Central Michigan University's global campus, the gold standard degree for government and nonprofit careers. Get it all at CMU's 7 local centers, Central Michigan University's global campus in Metro DC. Call 877-679-1268 or go online at cmich.edu/metro-dc.
Discover how government agencies are currently using data analytics to solve real-world problems at Predictive Analytics World for Government, September 17th and 18th, 2012, at the Ronald Reagan Building in D.C., featuring case studies, keynotes, workshops, an expo floor, networking, and much more. Don't miss out. Register today and connect with your peers and leading experts at this leading government analytics conference. Register today at pawgov.com. Save 10% when using discount code FEDNEWS.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected this week by Jeff Neal of ICF International and Rob Burton of the Venable Law Firm. And Rob, your most important story of the week is Jack Moore's story from federalnewsradio.com. GOP platform takes aim at the federal workforce. And this is a similar concept to what Jeff chose as his third most important story of the week. What did you see in what's in the platform, especially when we go back and look at how much of platforms from both parties ever wind up actually making it into policy?
Well, I do think this was the most important event of the week, the Republican National Convention. And so I felt compelled to have something as the number one story. And it makes sense to talk about how their platform is going to impact the federal workforce. I think there's a very interesting thing in here, Francis. Now, of course, the thing that's going to get the headlines is the proposal to downsize the workforce by 10% through attrition, I might add. But what's very interesting, if you look deeper, you're going to see the theme of outsourcing. And I don't know that this platform is necessarily about budget cutting, because it's really talking about moving work back to the private sector, especially when it comes to TSA. There's a proposal to actually have TSA run by the private sector. Doesn't necessarily say it will be cheaper. There's also indication that with respect to the Postal Service, that some of that should be the private sector should have a greater role with respect to running the Postal Service. This administration, as you know, has had a very well-defined insourcing initiative. The federal workforce has grown by 140,000 employees under this administration. And I think what this platform is saying by the Republican Party is we are going to reduce the size of the federal workforce, and we're going to move some of that work to the private sector. I think that's the most important takeaway here in the Republican platform with respect to the federal workforce.
And, Jeff, this is the problem that I have when I look at this. If you're committed to shrinking the size of the federal government, that's fine. That's a position to have. That's one side of a debate that's a legitimate side to take. But if you wind up spending the same amount of money and you have essentially the same number of people, just some of them happen to work for contractors and some of them happen to work for the agencies, I'm not sure you've really accomplished much of anything.
It's political smoke and mirrors. If you look at when someone says, I want to reduce the size of the federal government, my first question or my first request of them is define what you mean. Is reducing the size of the federal government reducing the number of people on the federal payroll? Or is it reducing the cost of the government? I think for the typical taxpayer, what they're concerned about is the cost of government, because the cost is what drives how many dollars come out of their paycheck. So you really have to define the term that you're looking at. The other thing is I think you need to get this out of political terms. At DHS, we had a very extensive balanced workforce program. And it was not an insourcing program. It wasn't an outsourcing program. If anything, it was a right sourcing program. We wanted to look at work that we did, whether it was in-house or contracted out, and see what kind of risk we assumed as a department. Sometimes it was more risky to have federal employees do the work. Sometimes it was more risky to have contractors do the work. Sometimes it was more expensive to have federal employees do the work. Sometimes it was more expensive to have contractors. And we decided that it really wasn't about trying to insource or trying to outsource. If you do that, you turn it into a religious argument for people.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who are true believers in outsourcing think nothing else will work. People who are true believers in insourcing think nothing else will work. And you really have to look at what you're trying to accomplish, what kind of risk you assume, and what the cost to the government is. And you find at DHS, we insourced about 3,500 jobs. When we did the analysis of the jobs we had outsourced, we found 9 out of 10 times that it was okay the way it was. There was no problem at all with leaving the work outsourced. So we found that risk-based approach was far better than the religious argument of being in favor of or opposed to outsourcing. It worked a heck of a lot better for us, and I think that's what the government ought to do as a whole.
Do you see hope that will happen, no matter who wins, whether the president's reelected or whether Governor Romney is elected president?
I think this goes back to one of my major points, and that is there are going to be cuts. There are going to be budget cuts. It's inevitable. I think it's inevitable that the federal workforce is going to shrink. Regardless of politics, because we simply cannot sustain the money that we're spending currently on anything, and that includes the federal workforce. So it is going to shrink. There's no question about that. It's largest it's been in its history, and I don't think that the government can sustain that for the future.
But it sounds to me like what Jeff is talking about, and he was honest with us about his point of disclosure, but it sounds like what he's talking about is a logical, measured way of trying to figure out what should the government do and then who should do it. And the two sides can...
One of the biggest problems in that whole debate is what does it cost? And nobody can agree on it. The Republican platform certainly implies that it's cheaper to hire private sector people. The government folks with a combination of their salary and benefits cost 30 to 40% more than private sector employees. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but this goes to the whole debate of how do you determine costs. I do know that the government has not always compared apples to apples. When they were doing some of the insourcing work or implementing the insourcing initiative, they were saying it was cheaper for government people to perform the work, but they were not doing apples to apples comparisons. So that is a big issue with respect to how do you determine what it really costs.
I wish we could devote the second hour of the show to that conversation, because it would take at least that long to sort through all of those things, and that's unfortunately where we have to leave the program today. Jeff, it was great to have you on the countdown. Would love for you to come back and do it again.
Thank you. Would love to.
And Rob, it's good to see you again as always. Have a great weekend, Labor Day weekend, both of you. Enjoy whatever it is that you do, and thank you very much for being on the program today. You can hear the Federal News Countdown posted later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com, and the stories that we talked about selected by Rob Burton of the Venable Law Firm and Jeff Neal of ICF International, both posted for you on the In-Depth page right now. Hour number 2 of In-Depth with Francis Rose is next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.